Welcome to the Art of Digitalization by eEstonia, the most digital society in the world. Listen to experiences about transforming governments and businesses, honest reflection on fails, successes, and visions for the future. Whether you're only starting on your own digitalization journey, want captivating insights from globally renowned experts, or just love Estonian straight-faced humor, this is the podcast for you. Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to The Art of Digitalization. As always, we are joining with you the host, Carmen and Erica, the digital transformation advisors from eEstonia, and we are really excited to bring May with a new topic. Carmen, what are we talking about?
So first of all, Erica, it's great to be back in the studio together with you. Nowadays, we're not together that much anymore. But today we have the pleasure to focus on education completely. So education in Estonia is very important. I would say it's part of our culture to focus on education, make sure that the children have access to the best in our schools. And this is essentially what we're going to talk about. A little bit about Estonia and a little bit about Indonesia as well.
As something that is really close to my heart, being a former educator, so really lovely to discuss this topic. But also, thanks to the merit of our high-performing children across the world. So you might have heard about the Education Nation about Estonia in the context of PISA tests, and Estonia's 15-year-olds are the absolute top in Europe and among the most high scoring in the world. Isn't that something to be proud of?
I am definitely proud of our children, of our teachers as well, who put so much effort into making sure that we bring up so many bright minds. And this is why we can dedicate a full episode on education. There's actually so much more we have to cover, right? But this month, we will talk about education in general in Estonia. How are we going to leverage artificial intelligence? Then we zoom out and take a trip to Indonesia to hear Kevin speak about EdTech revolutionizing Indonesia's education. And Erica, what are you going to talk about?
Oh, finally, we're coming back to Estonia, but we're still remaining global and rethinking a whole new education path and how we can minimize the gap that we see that we are lacking from IT specialists, and what the new practical education for adults is going to bring. Completely new level, really exciting education.
First up, we have Sten Kapten from the Ministry of Education and Research, spilling all the secrets behind the success of the Estonian education system and their focus for the future. Today I have the pleasure to talk to Sten Kapten, advisor from Ministry of Education and Research. Sten, before we start talking about everything related to education, please tell us a bit, what do you do on a daily basis?
Okay, I have a job that will most probably not be overtaken by AI in the very near future, because my work entails that I do a lot of kind of original thinking, out-of-the-box thinking, work that is hard to maybe, get a robot to just start doing. So I delve into a lot of the kind of big topics that we're working on in the ministry, from AI to digitization to teacher shortages, or to the teacher shortage, to the Estonian education model and where it's heading and so on. So I try to help out with all of the bigger problems that we have.
This is very interesting because we are also very soon going to talk about how do we prepare our kids for the future jobs that won't be overtaken by AI. So right on the nose. But before we delve into the future topics, there was a recent interview by The Guardian called Free Lunches, Brain Breaks and Happy Teachers. Why Estonia has the best schools in Europe? And I liked one question here. How did Estonia, a small country that is relatively poor compared with most of the EU, become an educational powerhouse? So what do you think, especially if we talk about, because technology in school is so important for us, computer literacy skills, why do you think Estonia is such a powerhouse when it comes to education in Europe, especially?
Right. Estonia found itself being able to start anew after the fall of the Soviet Union. And it turns out we were able to make some pretty good decisions that affected the whole nation. And I think everyone knows the story of the Tiger Leap by now, which basically kind of... this was the hardware part of the Estonian digitization revolution. So this was the hardware part. So what the Tiger Leap did was that it got computers into schools and it got teachers to learn about these computers, learn how to use them, and we had computer classes in schools and so on. So this was a very solid beginning. Of course, internet connectivity and so on, something that, you know, we've done pretty well with as well. So that was the start. This was followed by the Broke Tiger program. So when the Tiger Leap, you know, very simply put, dealt with the hardware, the Broke Tiger started thinking more about the software. So this was, you know, part of this program was this whole idea of teaching kids to program, to code. And this is already the software part. So I think, you know, one of the important takeaways for other countries who we've been talking to about as well, you know, in regard to our success story has always been that, you know, make sure that you've got the hardware part down and then you can kind of move on to the software part. So then we've had kids do robotics, learn kind of basic coding, you know, and these have been courses that have been made for, you know, very young children. So I think this is also something that's been very important. And this is, you know, this has put us in a good position. I think overall during the COVID pandemic, we saw that Estonians did relatively well in comparison to maybe many other countries. And this wasn't, I think, by chance. We were just very well positioned, and you know, this was the result of 20 plus years, and you know, that was a very fortunate that we you know, had all of this in place before. So those are maybe two important kind of programs that we've had, and maybe another one that is important is the IT Academy. The IT Academy, you know, in short, basically, just to kind of get the gist of it, the IT Academy idea was that when you go and study computer sciences, for example, not everyone who goes and studies computer sciences needs to become a PhD computer scientist. It's all, you know, we also need a lot of people who are, you know, just happy to do programming and coding, but who are not that, you know, scientifically slanted. So I think that's been very important to get this kind of vocational slant to IT education as well. So those are maybe the three cornerstones of Estonian kind of digitization success and how it's played out in education. And I think this has really paved the way for us to start considering what all of this means in the context of AI and what the next steps are that we need to take.
That's a very good lead to my second question, because at the briefing center as well, we get more and more questions related to artificial intelligence. How are we preparing ourselves, but especially our kids, for the future of not when we only talk about the workforce, right, but also critical thinking and navigating online amidst all the deep fakes that are becoming more and more real life? We have to already focus on these questions, right? So what is Estonia doing in that regard?
Yeah, this is a huge topic. Lots to say about this. So very, very intriguing. I mean, it was only a year and a half ago that we found out about ChatGPT, and that totally changed the education landscape, because now it's something that everyone's talking about. Now artificial intelligence finally seems real. It seems inevitable. And now we know that we have to actually do something about it. It's become an actual problem for everyone, including for teachers and for schools. I think this is where it all started, and this is why, you know, people actually needed to get a move on, because you had students handing in homework generated by a chatbot, and that is a problem. You know, what do you do in such a scenario? And of course, the teachers, you know, many of them, I'm sure, have already graded papers that were not written by the students. I'm you know, of course, there are students who will just have the chatbot write some sort of text for them, an essay, and then not be very critical with the editing, so that the teacher can look at that text and see that this student of mine, who otherwise wasn't a great writer, now writes like Shakespeare. You know, that seems like a huge leap in 1 week, you know, and I'm sure they'll put one and one together. But, you know, on the other hand, you'll have students who are significantly, you know, more tech savvy, who will, and you know, who will look at this work, who will make amendments, who will maybe use two chatbots. They'll have one write the work, they'll have the other edit it, and so on. And you run into all sorts of issues there where you can't ultimately check the, you know, you can't make sure who the author of this essay is. And I think one of the things that we did, you know, the ministry, was that we basically told the schools that, you know, we were offering a software. So the software was supposed to detect whether, you know, this essay or this text or whatever was generated by AI or not. But ultimately, you can never know for sure who the author is.
Especially because ChatGPT is getting better and better, and there are other options as well. So I don't think that soon the software, right, alone is going to be enough to detect whether the essay is written by AI or not. So
we switched the module off, and this was also, you know, us saying that, you know, first of all, you have the issue of you might ruin kind of teacher student relationships, because you can ultimately never tell if it's right or wrong. So this is a big problem in and of itself. But I think more importantly, you know, this is a great opportunity for teachers to start creating homework or tasks that are more, you know, that are cognitively more challenging. And I think this is one of the big topics around this. You know, we see the rise of metacognition. You know, this idea of you're not asking students for facts anymore, or you know, you might ask them for reasoning. You might ask them, you know, tell me more about this, because the teachers need to. You know, so this is something that I think the University of Tartu has done, and I'm sure the other universities here have followed suit. You know, they've started going over the tasks they give to their students. And so if a student, you know, they need to put the task into ChatGPT, see if the text robot or the text bot can solve this task. And if it can, then they need to kind of rethink this task. So, you know, this means that certain tasks will be gone forever. You can't give those tasks anymore. You need to find a way around.
These times don't only seem challenging for the students, but also seems very challenging for the teachers as well, right? Do we help them in that regard to help to sort of redesign their tasks so they wouldn't be that easily solved using different AI tools? Or do we have manuals, handbooks? How do we educate our teachers in this regard as well?
Very good question. So this is a really important topic. This is something that we're working on as well within the ministry to help out with this. We have Harno, our Education and Youth Board, who has already put together a very practical course for teachers to kind of help them get familiarized with AI, with chatbots and how to use them in their everyday work. And so the minister has called together an AI council. So this AI council is there to really speed up our thinking in regard to AI, in terms of what we should be thinking about, what we should be doing, to really make sure that we're on board. We kind of go along with all the changes that need to be done. So one of the things, or one of the central tasks that this AI council has suggested and that seems will happen, is that we need kind of mass scale courses for everyone on how to use AI. So this is, you know, this is when we talked about before, you know, this idea that we had the Tiger Leap,
right,
for the hardware, we had Proge Tiger for the software, so to speak, and now we need something else for AI, to really integrate, yeah, AI.
So the good thing here is that we are quite good at organizing mass trainings, right? So hopefully that's not going to be a big problem. We have experience. But additionally, if we move on from schools now, how do we look at AI as an opportunity in the future? So Estonia is not known for a lot of natural resources. Hence, we have to use everything we have that's in our heads, right? So how do we plan to leverage artificial intelligence in the work field and make sure that those students are able to, who are now adults, who are able to enter the work field and essentially start paying a lot of taxes to the Estonian state, right?
Yeah. So the key here is that to be successful with AI, you need to be able to know how to use AI. You need to know what it is, and you need to know how to use it. So how to utilize the technology. So as you mentioned, a small country. There are certainly countries out there that are significantly richer than we are. So we have to keep that in mind. So for Estonia to compete, you know, in terms of creating the technology, it's going to be a challenge. This doesn't mean that we're not going to do it and that there aren't going to be niches where we're going to, you know, see what we can do technology-wise. But I think the focus will definitely be on becoming incredible users of AI, so that everyone knows how to utilize AI, how to make you know, get the best out of AI. So we had this. This was from the Ministry of Economic Affairs and Communications. They had this study from Implement Consulting Group. I think this is a subsidiary or somehow linked to Google. But, you know, this was about the future of work and Estonia and so on. So I think the study, the key takeaways from the study were that if Estonia really gets on the AI train, then by the end of the decade or by the beginning of the next decade, we could see, I think it was an 8% rise in the GDP. So this is a huge, very significant
very
number.
Very significant, yeah.
And I think the really important key takeaway for us also in terms of education was that it was only 5% of the jobs that were facing a high risk of being totally automated. You know, this is one of the fears, you know,
yes, all,
you know, when we talk about AI and jobs and so on. But it was 61% of the jobs were, you know, likely to be augmented by AI. So this is very, very important. It means that close to 2/3 of workers in 10 years' time will have, you know, their work will be augmented by AI, which means that they will need to learn how to use AI in their daily tasks. So this means a rise in productivity, you know, growth of the economy and so on. So this means that we really need to get people to learn how to use AI. So if we don't have the resources to maybe be a world-beating AI technology kind of researchers and that we're creating the technology ourselves, we need to make sure we know how to use it.
Well, I'm happy to hear that Estonia is already thinking about this. And Sten, thank you so much for taking your time and enlightening us in the topic of education and artificial intelligence in Estonia. Thank you.
Sure, thank you.
And now it's time to take a trip from Estonia to Indonesia. And I had the pleasure to talk with Kevin Emeraldi from Kavtech Edu. He will explain us everything regarding EdTech and how EdTech is used to revolutionize Indonesia's education. Today, I have the pleasure to talk with Kevin Emeraldi from Indonesia. First of all, Kevin, please introduce yourself. What do you do and what does your organization do?
Thanks, Carmen. So I'm Kevin. I'm currently the Chief Operating Officer of Kavtech Edu Indonesia. Just to provide a quick context, Kavtech Edu is a government technology team that is founded to support the Ministry of Education, Culture, Research and Technology in Indonesia, where we essentially act as the thinking partner of the ministry in order to find the most ideal solution, especially on those relevant to technology-related transformation in Indonesia. Just to give a little bit more context, the team was founded about 3-4 years ago. We are about 500 person in size now, and we are still focusing at the moment in supporting various key initiatives of the ministry to transform the overall education landscape within the nation.
And before we go into the transformation elements, can you give us an overview of what does the education sector even look like in Indonesia?
Of course. So I think just to paint a picture, Indonesia is essentially an archipelago. So whenever we're talking about the size of Indonesia's education system, We'll always be talking about two different things here. Number one is the geographical challenges. We have about 17,000 islands in the country. And the second one is the quantity of the populations or the teachers itself. Just to draw some numbers here, in Indonesia, we have approximately 3.5 million teachers. We have 400,000 schools, which serve kindergarten all the way to year 12. And about 50 million students, which are distributed across the 17,000 islands in Java. So until 2019, of course, one of the primary focus or one of the area that has been relatively developed in Indonesia has always been the islands of Java, the islands where the capital city of Jakarta resides and other various big cities are also located. However, starting 2019, with also the inclusion of a government technology team within Indonesia, we are at the mission of making sure that education access are more inclusive through all the numbers of students and teachers, as I mentioned before.
Wow, that's quite a lot of teachers and students. Estonia looks completely different. We only are a million as a whole, as a population, but we, for almost 30 years now, have been investing very heavily into education because we believe that this is the best investment you can do. Mm-hmm. Although you're reaping the benefits longer, or it takes time to reap the benefits, but it's sure worth it. Mm-hmm. So how are you taking these challenges and opportunities and tackling everything through EdTech?
Yeah. So I think given the unique characteristics of Indonesia, and I'm a firm believer that each nation, Estonia, Indonesia, Singapore, each has a uniqueness to each of their own. In our case in Indonesia, one of the things that we always need to take into account is the level of change management that is always required every time we are rolling out a new technology product or platform. So in Indonesia, an offline intervention would always be costly. And more often than not, it will be either ineffective or time consuming. And whenever we are thinking about pushing out a particular transformation, technology intervention is always the forefront of what we're trying to do. There are a couple of main focus that we are doing. So number one is for all technology platform, we are thinking of what is the best form of technology that can promote inclusivity of access. Inclusivity of access for teaching aspirations and primarily training as well. Number two, we also want to promote a data-driven decision-making for targeted and efficient school improvement. And last but not least, because prior to prior to the current cabinet, many of the activities are still driven by a lot of manual intervention. We are also aiming to reduce burden on administrative processes. So those are the areas that we're trying to do, primarily for K-12 education ecosystem. But we aren't stopping there. For the past couple of years, we have also been focusing on higher education. I think this relates nicely to what we call as Indonesia Vision 2045, because in 2045, basically, we are going to be celebrating our 100th year of independence, where we are aiming or we are hoping to achieve a developed nation state by that time period. With that ambition also in mind, we're also focusing on higher education, where our objective is we want to provide equal access to real work experiences for all university students, because we firmly believe as we upskill the higher education graduates, we can then really tap in on Indonesia's demographic bonus and create a more capable workforce that is more ready to be embedded as part of the industry for the many years to come.
Can you bring any specific examples of projects that you have already implemented, either in higher education or in high schools or primary schools?
Of course. So I think I'll give two examples here. Let me start with K-12. So for K-12, one of our champion platform is what we call Platform Merdeka Mengajar, or in English is Emancipated Teaching Platform. So the issues that we have at hand with the geographical challenges and the large number of quantity we mentioned up front, teacher training facilities were primarily centralized around Java. So whenever there is a teacher that wants to be upskilled across other islands outside of Java, there are logistical challenges where we need to fly them to Java or to the capital city of Jakarta, and then subsequently provides training to them. So with that challenge in mind, basically we introduced the aforementioned platform, whereby this platform essentially aimed to act as a feature, not as a feature, sorry, as a vessel for teachers to learn, to upskill themselves wherever they are located in Indonesia. So we are limiting two restrictions here. We are removing two restrictions here, sorry. We are removing the restrictions of geography. And number two, we are also removing the restrictions of time, because we firmly believe that in order for teachers to be able to become a better educators, they need to be able to always upskill themselves whenever or wherever they are located. And that is essentially our emancipated teaching platform, or our platform Merdeka Mengajar. The second platform that we also have is what we call as Rapor Pendidikan or Education Scorecard platform. So every year in Indonesia, we conducted an annual national assessment, in which in this national assessment, the one who we really are assessing is the schools. And across all the thousands of schools, the 400,000 of schools which resides in Indonesia, there will be millions and millions of data lines generated. Now, data in itself, it's not going to be useful, because we don't just want to look at numbers. We want to be able to tell the schools, what are the areas of improvements that you have as an institution, and what is the order of priority of your improvement. We are assessing schools here based on three different parameters. Primarily, number one is literacy, number two is numeracy, and last but not least is the school climate, so that we know exactly what kind of environment the students are undertaking their education journey. So we hope that by doing this education scorecard platform, schools in Indonesia will then be able to know what are their areas of improvement, conduct planning that is actually based on data that is gathered and reviewed and renewed on an annual basis, and prioritize together with the local government on how to best tackle their identified areas of improvement.
Normally, whenever we want to implement something new and innovative, there tends to be resistance to change, and additionally, there are a lot of stakeholders to convince. Have you seen anything like this when it comes to the edtech solutions implemented, or do you see that teachers in Indonesia are instantly embracing all the solutions?
Yeah, I think when we started this journey, of course, there are some forms of aspiration / hope that whether it's the local governments or it's the teachers, they will automatically accept and embrace the changes. But essentially, as we roll out our product, as we develop the product, more often than not, it is not always the case. So there are a couple of strategies that we, of course, implement that we still continue to experiment until today. But there are three primarily winning formulas that we have derived from our experience. I think number one is we need to embark the government and the ministerial stakeholders as part of the collaboration process. I think more often than not, many of us who are coming from the private sectors has been accustomed to just only be thinking about the technology itself without really embracing the aspirations, the needs, and the pain points also from the government stakeholders. So in this strategy number one, what we are trying to do is we take these government stakeholders, we involve them in our design process, we iterate with them in the development process, and then as we address and we look into the customers or the users' feedback, we also loop them in. So they know full well on what it means to develop technology products. I think that's number one. Number two is the importance of a high quality technology infrastructure. Whenever we are trying to serve any particular platform or even doing a feature update, upon its launch, the number of users would be typically in the number of millions. So what that means is our technology infrastructure would always be tested. We need to always make sure that whenever our platform is live with new feature or new product, the reliability of the infrastructure is indeed ready for those teachers, for those students, and any other government stakeholders which are accessing. Ultimately, the strategy number two is about trust. Whenever you are trying to introduce something new to a particular group of people, one thing they always want is they want to make sure that they can see the impact, they can see the value. And before we're even to be able to convince them of the impact and the value, first and foremost, we need to make sure to be able to show them that this technology features is actually working. Whenever they open the platform, it doesn't crash. Whenever they're trying to sign in, the process is seamless, etc. And that's our second strategy. The third and last strategy is our continuous and relentless focus on the needs of the user. We never want to develop any product, or we never want to introduce any feature just because it is the most cutting edge one on the market. Whenever we're trying to do something, we always do extensive research. We talk to the users on the ground. We talk to teachers, principals, local governments across all the 38 provinces in Indonesia, as we're aiming to make sure that anything we're introducing is actually something meaningful that can actually address their pain points on a day-to-day basis. So those are our three main strategies in introducing technology platform in the nation.
And last but not least, I'm sure we have people listening from education innovation sector wanting to use technology to change the education landscape in their country. What would be your recommendation to them? Where should they start or what should they take into account?
Sure. So from our experience, the way we would advise on anyone, any organization, or any government institution wanting to start on education transformation is first and foremost focus on the quick wins. It is quite important to focus on the quick wins, or as we call it in our organization, we call it the good enough principle. We need to make sure that don't embark on a transformation that is too long or too large in terms of scale and timeline. Because education stakeholders, especially the students, typically has about a couple of years before they then go on to the next education stages of their life. So whenever we're trying to test something, focus on a relatively small sample size first before roll out on a massive scale. Focus on trying to find and then prioritize the pain points that matters most to them. And last but not least, don't try to always solve it all in one go. Don't try to always aim for the perfect product. Embrace your users, embrace your local government, embrace your ministerial stakeholders, and then get them all collectively involved as a one large scale technology education ecosystem. And then you iterate the product, and then you feel that you are building any platform or any technology together with them. Because then at the end of it, everyone would feel it's not the product of GovTech Edu. Everyone will feel that it's a collective effort, a collective product that is owned by everyone.
That is great advice. Thank you, Kevin. And last but not least, Kev, can you tell us what is next for GovTech Indonesia or sure GovTech thing. Edu?
Yeah. So Indonesia, as I mentioned earlier at the beginning of this conversation, are relatively new coming into the government technology space. So we started this whole journey about 3 to 4 years ago. And unlike some other nations, our government technology team are primarily still quite sectoral. So for example, we have a GovTech Edu that is designed for education. And then we have our colleague who are focusing on healthcare or any other sectors. So the plan for the future is, of course, first and foremost, merging all these teams under one formal entity that would then automatically be able to facilitate or promote cross-sectoral learning or cross-sectoral collaborations. Actually, as a fortunate news, our nation has just released regulations. It's the Presidential Decree number 82. At the year of 2023, that supports the legal framework for government technology team or GovTech Indonesia to actually be built. And then afterwards, hopefully after 2025 or the early part of 2025, the team which are merged and combined under one big umbrella can then serve more sectors beyond education and healthcare. Because as a nation that has a large level of ambition to become a developed nation by 2045, there are countless of other priority sectors that would need a combination of government policies and also technology intervention to ensure those ambitions are indeed met.
All that's left to do now is to wish you the best of luck. You're doing an incredible job, and I'm sure that the teachers and the students, they will all reap the benefits soon. Kevin, thank you so much for your time, and really good luck with all your endeavors in Indonesia.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. We are confident that we will be able to have a lot of collaborations together in the future with EE Estonia.
And now coming back to Estonia, a really interesting insight into how global education innovation is done. We are now looking what Koot Jõhvi is doing here in Estonia, how we are revolutionizing the way to provide really practical IT education and somehow try to help with the gap of IT specialists that we're really missing. So Lauri Haav here is next. Next up, we have a really interesting innovation in education. How do we study? What is the next level or different forms of studying? And to reflect a little bit from that point, we have a really good honor to host Lauri Haav, the CEO of Koot Jõhvi. Welcome, Lauri. Really lovely to have you.
Well, thanks for inviting me. And if I'm not mistaken, my old office is about 10 meters from this studio.
And that is also why you are here, an expert throughout all of the fields. Share a little bit. What have you done before? Where does your experience extend to?
Well, the most recent one, I suppose, which links me to this building here, I was the managing director of Estonia's e-residency program for 2.5 years almost. So it was a wonderful experience. Other than that, I've been usually in the private industry side and actually all the time in IT and technology. I'm a co-founder of an e-commerce company, but I also worked for software houses, startups, fintechs. But always connected to IT and software.
And now education. What drew you to education and what is Koot Jõhvi even? What do you do there?
So Koot Jõhvi is a new type of school, which doesn't have, well, one kind of element that if someone tells you about a school, then one element that comes to mind is what?
Lectures, professors.
And teachers. So this is one thing that we do not have. So we do not have any teachers. We don't have any lectures. It's only about coding. So this is a coding school and our aim is to give you the skills or help you get the skills of a full stack software developer. So not specific to one narrow field or one narrow speciality, but the full stack developer skills. So literally when you finish the school, you can go out there and become a programmer or start your own company, as many of our students actually have done.
What do you mean? Nobody's teaching me? Like, is it co-learning? Do I just Google or YouTube some videos? Or if nobody's there to share their experience, then how am I going to be a good programmer?
Well, that's an excellent question. So I think it mostly relies on the fact that people learn differently. And some people really, when they're really interested in the subject, and they can go really, really fast, right? So they can go through a lot of material in super, super, super speed tempo. And they don't really need to be kind of held back even by these kind of, let's say, classroom lecture tempo, basically. So that's like one premise. And the other premise is that people learn things when they do those things together. So this is something that I think, it's not specific to Estonia, but overall, I suppose the kind of more traditional classroom education type approach is quite individual. And of course, people have realized that it's an issue, but generally still it tends to be quite individual. And then the moment when you go to work in a company on a product type role, on a developer role, you realize that all the work is done in teams. So suddenly this is something that you really don't have that much experience in a kind of regular, normal world growing up. And then suddenly you go to a workplace and actually everything goes on in teams. So this is one thing that is like really like the pillar of this approach is that people who learn in our school, that they form teams and they work on projects as a team. So they literally have, you know, deadlines, goals, they need to build a project. I don't know, it could be an internet bank, it could be an e-commerce website, but they need to build it together. As a group, as a team.
That just feeds my soul because as former educator, one of my extracurricular classes was literally social competencies, how to accept cultural differences, how to be a tolerant society member, how to co-function in a society with people who have different opinions, different competences than you. And I see the same in primary education in Estonia as well, that more important than just, you know, feeding people knowledge, it is the co-creation. And as much as we can do practically, So this is where the value lies, that and that is what the students will finally remember. It's not all of the exact dates and the figures. That should not be the goal of the education, but really take the systematic competencies and teach those to the students.
Well, absolutely. And maybe another thing that comes to mind when I think about the type of model that we apply, right? So it's not like absolutely unique to Code Jõhvi, but there are other schools like that in the world, of course, who use similar methodology. Is the question of what comes first? Is it the theory or is it the practical problem that you have? And let's be honest, most of educational systems are built up in a way that theory comes first and then you're trying to seek a way how to put this in practice. So we and other schools like us turn this upside down. So we give you a practical task and a problem to solve first. So this is a problem you have to solve. Go figure out the theory behind.
And why IT? Also, very for me, it's very natural. And then the connection comes completely obvious. Estonia being one of the most digitalized societies in the world. We just need these people. And there is a really big myth, in my opinion, as well. All of the different audiences that we have in the briefing center, they say, well, yeah, you just, you know, fire the civil servants and basically, you know, humanless public sector or digital society, right? That's not so. We need more people than ever, but we just need people with different competences. So it is the drought of IT talent is a global issue. That's not something that is super Estonian specific. But in Estonia, under 5%, meaning around 30,000 people, work currently in IT. And also the admittance to IT-related study in Estonia is bachelor level, like 12%, and master's above 8%. And comparing that to OECD level or the OECD average, these are the half of these figures. The same indicators, 6 and 4%. So Estonia already has a double admittance. So that means that we should be like 50% or two times ahead than other OECD countries. But we still have an amazing gap between the actual reproduction of IT talents and the necessity. How big is this gap and why do we need initiatives like Code Jõhvi?
I think the gap is pretty wide, and then it a little bit depends on who do you speak to and what kind of numbers do you take. So let's say the conservative estimate is done by a government body which produces a report called OSCA, which is, I think it's available in English as well. Basically what they're saying is that we should have about 2,600 new IT specialists entering the field every year to fill the existing gap. And it's not just a gap in the high-tech industry, it's the all industries, because everybody needs software developers, like also the, you know, the government services also need software developers. So throughout the country, there is a need of 2,600 new people entering the workforce in this field a year, according to this report. And the output, if we can call it that, the output of all the educational institutions of Estonia combined who have software development studies is about 800 people a year. So more people enter, but literally like the people who graduate is about 800 per year. So there's quite a big gap between 2,600 and 800. And this is a conservative estimate, because there's also, Estonia is a startup country, of course, and we have a society called the Founders Society. And their vision is that by 2030, a good 20% of Estonia's economy could be and should be high tech. But in order to fulfill that vision, there should be 5,000 new people entering the ICT field every year. So it depends on which number you look at. Is it 2,600 or is it 5,000? Either way, it's way, way, way above what our current output is. And then to put this number, 800 software developers coming out of educational system per year in some kind of context, then Code Jõhvi was founded, 3 years ago? And now we have 100 graduates. So just like in this little short time period, we literally have added more than 10% into the whole output of the country. And the reason, of course, being that this program is, first of all, super practical, but it's also much shorter. So, and by shorter, it also means that it's more accessible, right? So if you have to study for 4 or 5 years, so not everybody's able to afford this.
either cannot commit to such a long time.
Either cannot commit or also financially maybe could not afford this. And also there are quite high limits of entrance and high barrier of entrance, like what kind of grade averages and what kind of state exam levels you must have to even be admitted to university. Now, our admittance works a little bit differently.
Before we get to admittance, you also, which is remarkable to say that you say around 100 graduates, but around 80 have already found really practical jobs as developers or coders. So that's amazing also number that you get something super practical and basically your job is guaranteed, right? There's a really, really big chance of you getting a job.
Well, there's one thing is getting a job, but also really, really proud that already three new startups have been founded by the former students or existing students of Koodyufi. And I think this number could be even higher, because in the end of the day, if you have those skills to build something, do you necessarily need to wait for somebody to offer you a job or offer you a career? Why not start your own, right? So I'm really hopeful that we can encourage this further in the future.
10 unicorns per capita makes us number one in Europe and second in the world. So a lot of it is asked also like, why unicorns here? Well, now you get your answer. I mean, these are brilliant minds everywhere. But a bit of the background also in 2023, the response to Koodyufi's call for coding enthusiasts and global call has been nothing short of phenomenal, because remarkable 3,600 applications really poured in. And just to give you a bit of a background, they represent 92 distinct nationalities. So this overwhelming global engagement is really the proof that that there is a high interest in education, exactly how you say, very flexible form of education. And that's Koodyufi's worldwide impact. Koodyufi itself is a relatively small city in eastern parts of Estonia, but you have such a global impact and an interest. Why?
Well, I suppose the model itself is intriguing, but also the way we recruit new learners is also quite different. So first of all, we have very few technical requirements, so very few barriers of entry. So basically, we don't even ask for a high school diploma. The only thing you have to be is you have to be 18 years of age, so you have to be an adult, and you have to be able to come to Estonia for at least 2 or 3 weeks a year for our selection sprint period. And I suppose also you need to be able to speak and read English at some level, because the whole coding world is mostly English, so that's a requirement. But that's about it. So if you have these requirements nailed down, then you're free to try.
And know what
do
happens.
A little test.
Yeah, know what happens. What's the test?
So the test is actually an online game. So we ask you to play a game for 1 hour. And if you reach a certain level, then like a magic portal opens in a way. So if you reach a certain level, then we will invite you to a secret rendezvous at Yuffie, which then takes place in the physical world, in the actual schoolhouse at Yuffie. And this is then 2 weeks of nonstop coding camp on site. And if you get through that, then you're admitted to actually start your studies.
So all the ears of the gamers listening to us, like, what? I'm supposed to play a video game and that gets me the possible admittance to the coding school.
Exactly.
Very attractive.
Exactly.
Amazing user experience, I would say. Just play video game for a while. But it's not only in Estonia, right?
So currently, yeah, so we are, of course, expanding this model. So we're also expanding in Estonia. Today we have one school. This is the original school where we started 3 years ago. There is a project to open another one in the southern part of Estonia, close to the Latvian border, next year. And there's also a group of interested people working on a project to open a similar school in the middle of Estonia as well. So then I think probably that covers all parts of our small country, that everybody would have one digital church in their neighborhood. And I think this is super important, actually, also to get these kind of initiatives outside of the capital and outside of the major university towns, where people have a lot of choice anyways, right? So there's like adding another technical school to a city where there's already five of them existing doesn't really maybe add that much. So it's not only the question of kind of changing the requirements for admission and making it more gameful and playful and removing some of the obstacles which we see as obsolete, actually, that they don't really necessarily tell the future of how the person will perform, because many of that is totally arbitrary. But the other part is also making it accessible in your neighborhood or creating these kind of new opportunities outside of the major region. So to that end, actually, we also have a school starting quite soon. I think the news will be public in June. But it's also quite similar in the fact that it's also not in a major city. It's in another country, but it's not in a major city. But it's a regional center which has a lot of potential. But maybe also the kind of younger people have been moving away and have been looking for jobs elsewhere, because you know there hasn't been possibilities to get the education locally. They had to either travel to the capital city and live there for 4 or 5 years, and that again is not affordable either money-wise, or time-wise, or commitment-wise to everybody. So people then just tend not to, or they move away altogether. But let's be honest, most of the IT jobs are relatively remote nowadays. So it's either hybrid. Of course, there are companies who say you have to be in the office, you know, certain days per week. But there's much more companies who are now more flex regarding the roles and where people can work. So you really like usually the quality of life in a smaller place is usually amazing, right? So you know everybody knows you, and the neighborhoods are super safe, etc. So there's great value of people also living in smaller cities and smaller towns, but doesn't mean that they can't work for another company in a bigger city or another company in a different part of the world.
So very often we're asked also about the export of Estonian education solutions, and that's a wonderful thing. We can make these systems scalable, these ideas can be spread, and finally, all across the globe, we really have similar needs. We have necessities for and growing necessity for IT talent. So you mentioned the vision until 2030. What do you think in 6 years, what is going to happen with Codiafi's graduates, with additional workforce going onto the labor market? What do you assume that the level of graduates are going to be, or how big impact in addition to the traditional education institutions in IT fields, Codiafi will contribute?
Well, two or three things come to mind. So number one, I really hope by that time there will be at least one unicorn founded or co-founded by Codiafi students, either from Estonia or from another country.
So all of the students, be aware, the CEO is expecting good solutions.
Definitely. and on the vision part, like why we even started the school, or what we look for as an impact, we have a very shy vision. We want to impact 1 million people. So right now we have 700 students. So there's quite a lot of ways to cover, but no worries. We're just getting started. And we are definitely looking for a scalable model to expand from here on.
Wonderful, Lauri. Thank you so much for this conversation, for giving a bit more insight to what the future education model looks like, how it is flexible, how it is fun and playful, and how can that be accessible also for traditionally a bit marginalized or people who have had lower accessibilities to these wonderful solutions and education that finally could give you a job remotely.
Well, absolutely. And two things just to finish. So if you're interested in studying at Codiafi, then you're most welcome to do so. You don't need even a student visa. Just you need to be able to reside in Estonia for 2 or 3 weeks. So that's all the requirement there is. And also, if you're interested in starting a school in your neighborhood, then do give us a shout.
And do give us a shout out to us as well. So we will put the information to our show notes, and all information about Codiafi will be accessible there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that was an episode full of packed with lovely insight across the globe. If you were as excited as us and got new information, then definitely comment to us and let us know what did you like. Or if we did not touch something, some topic, then definitely let us know as well. If we spiked your interest with this episode and with these lovely speakers, then you have extra material also in show notes. Go and check out. There's a bit more extra material about the background, the PISA test results, and you will learn heaps of new details.
And with this, we wrap up today's conversation. Thank you to our listeners. Without you, the Art of Digitalization podcast wouldn't exist. We will continue bringing to you all the hot topics discussed in technology. And our next episode is out already next month. But meanwhile, follow at ESTonia in social media to keep up with the latest trends on digitalization. As always, we are your hosts, Carmen and Erika. Thank you for listening, and until next time.